From JetBooks, this is Irish Business Builders, a show about great Irish businesses and the people who build them.
The best selling technique is honesty. Do not say you can deliver when you have a doubt. And if there's one thing we got right, particularly over competitors, was exactly that.
I'm Conor Carney, and that's the voice of Vincent Carton, former CEO of Manor Farm, an eighth generation family business which they sold in 2017. In this episode, Vincent brings us all the way back to 1775 and tells us the story behind one of Ireland's oldest surviving companies. 200 years later, Vincent and his brother Justin bought out all of the remaining shareholders and went about professionalising the business. They intensely focused on understanding their customers, streamlining operations, and selling off underperforming divisions. Towards the end of this first episode in a special two-part series, you'll hear how Vincent nearly lost the business in 2003 and how an old college friend from UCD helped him turn things around. I started off this conversation by asking Vincent to give me a brief history of the business of Manor Farm.
So Manor Farm was an eighth generation family business. The trading company was called Carton Brothers, and I was the eighth generation to run it in Manor Farm. It was a chicken processor. So it involved everything from the breeding side, that's the hen side of the business that creates the eggs that become chicks that are grown. We had our own feed mill to feed both flocks. It came into the processing plant to process the chicken and sell them. Our primary customer, we were 75% retail and 25% food service, roughly speaking. When I left in June of 2019, we were processing 1 million birds a week. Our turnover was of the order of about 175 million in chicken and about 125, just over the 300 we were in total in chicken feed and chicks. We had 850 people. To date, it's about 1,000. And it was primarily a business that was based in Dublin, coming from the fruit markets. Back in the day, in the fruit markets part of Dublin, there was a fruit market, a vegetable market, a fish market, there was a meat market, there was a clothes market, there was a daisy market, there was all sorts of markets in there. And my forefather, George Carton, started the poultry and game market. And what that involved primarily at the time was hens who, when they got to the end of their egg-laying life, pull the neck, tie about a dozen of them together, get them to a railway station. So we would collect the chickens, bring them to our market, sell them off to traders, to shopkeepers, take off our commission and send the check, a postal order back to those people. And what was fascinating about that, for about 170 years, we did that and they didn't know us and we didn't know them. It was purely based on your word that you did what you said you were going to do. And we did. And the thing at the time, though, was boiling fowl, which is what they were called, because the only way to eat it, spent hens to boil it. You could not roast it. But once a year, a thing called a spring chicken came into the market. And a spring chicken was the male offspring of the clutch of eggs that were grown in the market. And a hen does not need a cockerel to produce eggs. In fact, a fertilized egg obviously becomes an embryo of a chick, which wouldn't be a particularly nice experience for making an omelet. So an unfertilized is actually preferable in some ways. So the male bird, what was amazing about a spring chicken was it could be roasted. So as mutton is to lamb, boiling fowl was to spring chicken. Problem with spring chicken, it only came in for about 4 weeks of the year. And after that was back to a thing. And if you talk to somebody, or I talked to somebody when I started business, anybody who is in their 50s would remember it as a child that chicken, roast chicken, was an absolute delicacy. It was expensive and it only came in at a very tight time of the year. It was wonderful. And so what actually happened was that the Americans were the ones that understood the system. And whereas in the farmyards of Ireland, you'd have hens and cockerels and baby chicks all running around the same yard, what they did in America was they divided the flocks. They said, right, we're going to have breeder flocks, which are hens with cockerels, and you one cock to every 8 females, and you will produce fertilized eggs out of these farms. They will go to a new entity called, or an incubator called a hatchery.
Mm-hmm.
And what the hatchery did was incubate the chicks, the eggs, and produce chicks. And as day-old chicks, they get sent out to a whole new set of farmers called growers. And the growers raise the baby chicks to marketable weight, and then they're taken into the processing plant where they're slaughtered, eviscerated, cleaned up, and then made into products, portions, fillets, mm-hmm. eggs, wings, whatever. So that was that's what the Americans came up with. That part of the business really only started in Ireland in the 1960s. And there was a feed milling family up in Monaghan town called Patton's Feed Mill. Mm-hmm. And they brought a dozen farmers over to America to show them the idea of this barn-reared chicken. And that's what it was. And so farmers, instead of producing dozens, were now producing thousands. And where do you think they came to try and sell the product? To the Dublin poultry market. That's where we got involved.
Mm-hmm.
And worst was that two farmers would come into the market in the same week, and the price would collapse, and then there'd be weeks of no supply.
Mm-hmm.
So we very quickly got to know these guys, and we said, we organise your week one, farmer two, three, four, five, six, seven, and then you come back again. So we started regularising supply,
mm-hmm.
and we then recognised that supply from the growing farms were dependent on supply of the eggs from. So in 1968, my father built Ireland's first commercial hatchery in Carrickmacross, County Monaghan, and we had that until 2008. We closed it down. In 1970, he moved the factory, which was just off Capel Street, can you imagine, and moved it up to Shercock, County Cavan. And the reason he did so was water. You needed an awful lot of water to process the chicken. Mm-hmm. And the week before they transferred to Shercock, County Cavan, they produced just shy of 100,000 birds in Capel Street, Dublin. Just off Capel Street.
Mm-hmm.
Can you imagine?
Yeah.
I know. So it was transferred up. They went up to that area because to be closer to the farms. And the reason is that a chicken loses 0.5% of its body weight for every hour it's in the truck. Just living will do that. So getting closer to the meant you didn't lose that. And that was important to the economics of the business. And then in 1976, he closed the loop. And if you ever want to, I don't know if you believe in miracles, but there's a story about our feed mill and a miracle. Because it isn't called Carton's Feed, it's called Calvé, after a saint. So I'll just explain that. So in 1974, 2 years before this, my dad running the business and noticed that the quality of feed, we were working with many feed mills, small ones, around where the farmers were. And quite frankly, they were mixing nuts with chicken feed, with pig pellets and turkey feed. And quite frankly, that is serious. That does affect the chicken seriously.
Mm-hmm.
It must get the right nutrition at the right time of life. And getting wrong hurts. So he wanted to produce and wanted to build his own feed mill. And the first person he went to was Bank of Ireland, or banks, and they said, under no circumstances, farmers, credit, bad news. They just don't pay. You'd use up far too much credit.
Yeah.
It's not the capital, it's the working capital would be the problem. Mm-hmm. So they said no. The second people who said no was the Cavan County Council, because a feed mill is actually a very tall structure, a superstructure in steel off which is hung production lines that use gravity to flow it through.
Right, mm-hmm.
So you go, it's the product is raised through elevators, released down through a grinder,
mm-hmm.
or a pelleter or a dryer, whatever it is. It will. That's where the gravity comes in. In each stage, you're raising it up again afterwards. Tall structure, about 6-7 stories high, and the Cavan County Council said, no way, not in our lovely county, are you going to be allowed to do that? So that's fine. So that was a no.
Mm-hmm.
And then the last thing that was no was that we needed to get 3-phase industrial power.
Mm-hmm.
We were in rural Cavan, and it just wasn't anywhere to be found. So my mum's sister had devotion to a man called Maximilian Calvé. Maximilian Calvé was a Polish parish priest who ended up his days in Auschwitz, because he was a pain in the neck. It was annoying them. And what actually happened, how he lost his life in the end, was that the Germans were conducting experiments in the camp, and they called out a dozen people that they wanted to, who were already emaciated and starving and all that, and they just put them into a cell that's no food, no water, and see how long they take to die. And one of the people chosen was actually a parishioner of Maximilian Kolbe. And I suppose the first small miracle was that Maximilian put his hands up and said, look, I'll take this man's place. He's his wife and kids. I know him. And they said, okay. And he then proceeded to bugger up their trial by hymns and prayer, kept them far longer than they should. And in fact, he was the last one to die. And eventually they killed him with a lethal injection. He didn't even die. So, and he was a blessed by this stage. Obviously, John Paul II was a Polishman, and he was moving this guy's canonization process along. And my dad, you know, started praying to this man. And within a week, three things happened.
Mm.
The first was Bank of Ireland came back and said, so you were talking about credit, weren't you? And my father said, no, we're going to buy back all of the chicken that the feed is, so we will always owe them.
Mm-hmm.
The crop credit is purely on the basis of the chicken. Mm-hmm. We won't be giving them any other credit outside of it. Oh, absolutely. So I understand that. You can have the money. Second was Cavan County Council had appointed for the very first time an economic development officer. So they're pretty normal now in most counties, or in all counties, but back then this was brand new. And this was the only project that went over his desk. There was nothing else going on in the country. So he sat down with Dad and he said, look, you know we've refused your planning permission, yeah? Or sorry, he came and said, look, I'd like to understand your project. He said, but you guys have refused us already.
Mm-hmm.
He said, yeah, but just tell me about it. What are you planning to do? Well, the idea is what is a mill? A mill is a tall superstructure. You build concrete foundations and then you bolt on this steel structure and off which you hang these productions. He said, stop. What do you mean? So could you move it? Well, my father said, absolutely not. You know, this is a tall structure. There's no way you'd move it. My father said, you wouldn't move it. He said, I didn't ask you, would you? He asked you, could you? I suppose you could on both the things, and you could move to another one if you had a crane big enough to move a building. Doesn't need planning permission. So the mill was built without planning permission.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third one, which I find most incredible of all, is the ESB announced that they were building a power line. And where did they put the substation on this new power line? But literally on the property adjoining where the feed mill site was, in the middle of nowhere in Cavan.
Mm-hmm.
So my father said, fair enough. He said, unbelievable, just couldn't believe, you know, this immediate. He said, if this man is ever made to say it, I will go to Rome to be at his canonization.
Mm-hmm.
And he was in 1987. And you know who was also there? Yeah. The man whose place he took in Auschwitz concentration camp.
Survived. All that time.
Yeah.
Wow.
So business is called Kolbe Feeds.
Mm-hmm. After the saint.
After the saint.
At what stage did you get involved in the business?
So yeah, I had two stages. So I did a BCom in 1979. And I knew I wanted to be in the family business, by the way, which happens to so many other people that I now know in the family business network. We all would have been brought to the factory, to the shop, to the warehouse, the office, whatever it was, mm-hmm. before the age of 10, and I was too. And then we tended to go off, get educated and professionalized, and then we'd come back. And the numbers on that are quite incredible. That, yes, the instigator, the real entrepreneur is the first guy. But the professional adaptation usually adds tenfold mm-hmm. in value to what the first generation did.
Mm-hmm.
That third is another game, another discussion altogether.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's what tended to happen. So I joined and I realized I made a mistake in my life. Oh my God, this was an old-fashioned, staid business, absolutely just plodding along.
Mm-hmm.
It was into many businesses. There was eggs, there was wines and spirits, butter, cash and carries,
mm-hmm.
and they were all a mess. And they were all closing down one by one, and you can see why. Mm-hmm. There was very little And I certainly was totally demotivated. I was worse when another person from the other side of the family, I was twinned with, and I would only develop if that person developed at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way I was going to put up with that. So I studied cost and management at night, did it, and I left in 1983. I went to the Penn tennis ball factory in Mullingar. I was engaged to my wife Liz, and we, in 1984, I moved back to Dublin and became a management accountant with Shield Life Insurance, which today is Zurich, in BlackRock. And we got married that year. And in 1985, I think it was, the shareholder on the other side of the family with a key shareholding had no children and said, look, I'd like to give it to you and not my nephew. A big decision because of something the nephew had done.
Mm-hmm.
And so we tried to work it out. CAT was a real problem, capital acquisition tax.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, the man dropped dead. But in 1988, after probate, his wife sold me his shares. She knew what he wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
So I bought the shares from her. My father gave his shares to my brother, Justin. We put the two together and we went after all the other shareholders and bought them all out. So here we were, an eight-generation company with two shareholders.
How did you structure that deal for yourself? I mean, you...
So the first lot was the expensive ones, the ones I had to buy, savings and borrowings and all that good stuff that you do. And you take your step into the... Justin's was relatively easier. Again, another very interesting story on how the capital acquisition tax was assessed on that.
Mm-hmm.
Because in 1987, Edwina Curry stood up in the House of Parliament and said that two-thirds of chicken were salmonella. And you can imagine what happened to the value of a chicken company.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was the time we chose to transfer.
Mm-hmm.
So the transfer value was finally settled at a very low level so that we didn't have to pay tax.
Right.
So that was one of the positives.
Yeah.
But you were taking your life in your hands buying into a chicken company then when literally the world had fallen asunder.
Yes.
Anyway, we did. And the way we structured, so the first, the chairman, when we put the two together into a company called Carton Group, once we got access to all of the shares, we could now, we borrowed a little for a short period of time in that business, and when it then owned all the shares, we could pay it back with the cash from the business. So that's the way we structured it.
You must have had some confidence at that time that you could have made more of the business or improved
it. Absolutely, yeah. So I remember in particular, one part of the business was eggs, and I just remember it was a loss maker. But, and it was part of the reason why I'd left the business was they wouldn't make a decision, wouldn't face up to sins of the past. So I knew immediately, just by closing this thing down, I was going to double profit.
Mm.
And that's what I did. So I knew going in the door, my father in particular questioned the salary I wanted to pay myself. And I said, I guarantee you I'll make that tenfold in the first year. And I did by closing down the business that was going nowhere. We had no part to play in it. And we had lost, there was nothing viable about it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And it was great. We got out of it and got some dosh, and it was great. That was how we did, got involved. So in 1988, we now, myself and my brother, own all of the shares. My father is the CEO, but quite frankly, I took on the role of finance director.
Mm-hmm.
Literally, my father didn't, there was no plan, there was no talk about it, and we'd raise a couple of times, look, you know, what should we do about succession and that? And there'd be nothing coming back. What do you mean? I'm here, you know. But myself and my brother just loved our dad. You know, we revered the man and we were never going to push. Well, you know, once there was nothing coming back positive, we didn't. It's particularly when we got into the 90s, the role of CEO was known. So, for instance, my father never spoke to a customer.
Mm-hmm.
He was very much back into the production. And, you know, that was a mistake. You know, he'd be rolled out against the bank for bank meetings, but really wouldn't understand it. There certainly wasn't a plan. It was more, you know, we go from day to day and see what happens. So things needed to change. And actually it was my mum, our CEO, as I call her, the chief emotional officer, who got us around the kitchen table and said, look, we want this thing to go on. And what came out of that discussion was amazing. And as I said, I've helped about five other Irish family companies because they too have the same problem. And it is that the senior generation didn't want to talk about succession. My father believed that we would want him out of the place if we took over.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing could be further than true. We didn't even know about this. And when this came out, what are you talking about? Of course you're going to be with us.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually created a board of directors with two external directors, more of his vintage to be able to support him more than us, and obviously support us too, but we created a board of directors. He had some projects that he really, really wanted to complete. We said, of course, keep going.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing's going to stop you there. And of course, his salary. My dad wasn't particularly commercial and he needed support on the financial side, mm-hmm. and was worried about that and had never faced up to it.
Mm-hmm.
And now once we saw that was the problem, okay, let's put in place a plan for you to get paid properly. And it just took all that away from him. In 1998, I became CEO. And Justin and myself, we had had a discussion where we said, look, we both agreed there should only be one leader. And we came to terms among ourselves how to do that.
Mm-hmm.
That has lasted all the time since.
What were your strengths at the time as you saw them in order to be able to become the CEO?
Yeah, so certainly I had financial, so I was a finance director. And I also, to be fair, had an idea of where we wanted to go.
Mm-hmm.
I knew what we wanted to do. As simple as, let's get to know our customers. And I mean, nothing fancy. And actually, very interesting story came of that that really changed our business so much. Pure accident. This didn't happen. So the problem was that we were a main partner supplier to Superquinn, their chicken. They're a great company. Everybody in Dublin would know them. They were innovative. They were very personable people, and you could work with them and everything. And the purchasing director of Superquinn came to us and he handed me a yellow card. He says, do you know what that is? And I said, yeah, it's a yellow card. He said, do you understand what it means? It means that if I issue another yellow, I won't even talk to you about supply chicken. We'll just kick you out. We don't care what you do. All I can tell you is you are not supplying us. You're our number one customers. Of course I'm supplying you. And I could see that we had a 99.7% supply rate.
Mm.
You know, wow, of course we are. He says, all I can tell you is, Vincent, you're not doing the job. In our world, you're a muck. You're not supplying us, and that's the word everybody has on you, Grant. I said, okay, I just don't understand. He said, okay, I'll tell you what I'll do. You can go anywhere you like in Superquinn and find out what's going on. So what I did was I hopped on a truck and followed at those days we were delivering industry. And I remember going into Northside Supermarket and the manager there, when he saw me coming in the truck, he said, you, FFFF, you, BBB. And what he said is, you buggers, you're constantly leaving me short. I said, what do you mean we're leaving you short? Here's a case in point. You know, it was, let's say it was 1,000 cases and we, of a whole pile of products, and we were delivering something like 980. $20. He says, only 20 bucks short. He said, yeah, but what are they short of? I said, what do you mean, what are they short of? We've done your big ones, your cases of fillets and your Holberts, the big volume product. We had thousands of cases of those. He says, I'm not interested in those ones. I'm interested in the value-added products. But I said, there's only you know, a couple of cases in that. He said, exactly. But every time Fergal Quinn comes to this store, he has a coffee with his shoppers. And the one thing he wants to ask them is, how do they like their new chicken products? And every time I have to tell him, you're not delivering. I said, what? And he said, and I couldn't understand this. 20 cases, what are you doing? And what it turned out was absolute pure gold and changed my business life. So what Fergal was doing was having cups of coffee with his shoppers, as he called them. Today you call them focus groups.
Yeah.
And he was finding out. And think of a product, a chicken fillet with feta cheese inserted into it, wrapped in Parma ham and a sun-dried tomato product. Sounds delicious, in a foil tray.
Mm.
And Fergal would go to them and say, what did you think of that product? Oh, geez, it was gorgeous. Fergal is the best thing ever. It was gorgeous, loved it. And he said, and do you mind me asking, did you buy it again? No, I didn't. Why didn't you? I'll tell you what I did, Fergal. I had your chicken fillet. I had your chicken fillet. But I had a bit of cheddar cheese. And I wrapped it in a rasher. And I had a bit of dolmio. So they were mimicking what we were doing.
Mm-hmm.
From our side, as a production orientated business, we were looking at production, and this was a small run. What Fertile was looking about was, how can you differentiate yourself as a supermarket when all the products are the same? The halibuts, the fillets, they're all the same.
Mm.
The promotions are all the same, because if a half price works on one, they all do it. And what he wanted to do was to make Supergoods known for difference. The problem to solve it was dead easy. That's, I don't give a shit about the big number. Just tell me about the value-added products that they're interested in.
Yeah.
And we solved that overnight.
Mm-hmm.
That became priority number one. Every day I got a report to tell me I want to see every single case.
Mm-hmm.
But what it also meant was that you were coming up with these small volume products that were on the shelf. People were buying them once, liking them, but not buying them again. But they were buying the fillet and the halibut mm-hmm. volume product.
Mm-hmm.
So our logic was we could grow the category, and it did. So Supergoods had a national grocery share of 8%, but in the end they were selling 13% of all chicken in Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
So they were over trading, because over time we were able to show shoppers new ways of eating chicken through these value added products that didn't sell much.
Mm-hmm.
We went on to do the same thing for every other supermarket. So each of them had their range, but we were able to grow the category, whereas everybody else was just discounting it with promotions and stuff. We were actually increasing it.
So at the time, people would nearly use the promotion as an entry-level drug as such, and then they would buy the chicken after that.
Yeah, the promotion was really a volume driver. And by the way, they were successful, don't get me wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're comparing year on year, you did the same promotion the same week last year.
Yeah.
And there's nothing growing about it.
Yeah.
Whereas if you had products coming in all the time, people were consuming more chicken. And if I showed you the consumption of chicken numbers over that time, you would see chicken was growing, where everything else, beef had pretty much plateaued, pork was slightly in decline, lamb was just the way it was, flat, mm-hmm. chicken was growing. And in 2007, we surpassed pork as Ireland's favourite meat. So Irish people eat more chicken than any other meat, including beef.
You know, any other time you were getting sort of difficult feedback from a customer, is it difficult not to take it personally? Is it part of your disposition not to take it personally and to try and do something about it?
Well, at that time, to be honest, I was just in the door as CEO. And I got this from our most scared shit, to be very honest with you. I really was scared that we were going to lose the business. And I could not understand what was going on. But it showed me loud and clear we were a production-led organization. Simple as.
Mm-hmm.
And that changed the next day. We saw Supergoods. From now on, and the way we did it was we set up key account managers within our sales team. Rather than having selling teams, we had people devoted to customers.
Mm-hmm.
So now we were one person dealt with all aspects. So we could hear if there was a problem in Killarney in Duns, or if there was a problem in Dublin or Galway. We got all that feedback. It was now in one port, and that manager was now defending the customer within our business.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was my job to see what the hell was causing that. We turned that around again into a product we call hooks. So here we are, we're producing a commodity. How can we get into your business, our customers, that we become essential part of their business? One of the ways we did it with Supergoods, to start with, was that Supergoods went into central distribution. This is where there's a warehouse, usually the side of the city, in Dublin in this case, which has lots of doors on one side, space in the middle, and lots of doors at the other side. And it operates best when it's at zero.
Mm.
So let me explain what that means. So we get the order and we deliver into them between the hours of 6 p.m. and 10 p.m. And they would then break down those pallets and say halibuts for Blackrock and another one for Ballantyre or wherever. And then they'd do the same with the dairy and everything. And now they would send one truck from this central warehouse to the store with all of the fresh product. Okay, so rather than have all these trucks going individually, far more efficient, very much saved a lot of money. But the problem was you had to work in a 4-hour window, and every other food company was in the same game. So we said to Supergoods, I tell you what you do, give us your order, not by pallet, give us individual store orders, by whatever they are, and we will make up individual pallets for you of all the different, we'll do the picking basically in our factory. We came up, my brother, to be fair to him, came up with a computer system how to do that. So now we were allowed, and by the way, if you missed the 10 o'clock deadline, they costed them overtime, because people had to wait for their chicken to finish them. So what we did with this is, we were being told to get in at 6 previously. Now we were able to come in at 10, because we went not to the indoors, we went to the outdoors, and had all the product prepaid for them. So what that meant? That meant we were now we were actually in their system, and we developed that further based on the orders that we were now receiving, and the fact we had connected with the customer. We now made a forecast of what BlackRock or Palantir should order for a particular product, and when it didn't do it, we could make a call right away and say, "Hey, by the way, should we put on more there? Do you see? I think he's forgotten there's a promotion next week. We should be a double that number." And so it drove our sales, and it drove their sales. So we were now, as I said, hooked in. So if we now had to talk about price, well, you know, it's difficult to throw someone out when he's part of your business.
Yeah.
And we developed that further, that same concept of every customer, yes, we're supplying a product, but how can we supply some service? And one of the big ones is the fact that the buyers usually of poultry are also the buyers of meats. And they just don't have enough time. Like there's 100 SKUs in chicken alone. There must be 500 SKUs in the rest of them. And the poor devil who's buying doesn't have the information. So we came up with a report based on our high supply rate that told them the margin they were going to get on their week sales of chicken on a Friday once we got the order for Sunday. So we were able to tell them about their business before they knew it.
So you're integrating into their business. So it was
hooked in.
Yeah.
And now we became a part of their management team. So one of the important things was to talk about, we could produce their margin report before they got it. And we could tell them, by the way, folks, if you do this, and that extended itself further. So when we planned promotions, by the way, you're actually going to lose money on this one because this is, why don't we do X? Oh God, that's a great idea. And off we went. So we were now very much involved. That's exactly where we want to be.
How difficult was it to come up with these strategies, plans to implement them?
Not really. Once you found out that, you know, the scale of our customers, there's 6 customers in Ireland buying 85% 80% of a retail chicken. It's huge purchasing power. So the upside of getting it right and the downside of further competition was so big, you know, we'd do anything. Being honest, and I see now in retrospect, I almost went too far. I bent over backwards. And it wasn't efficient in some of the things we do, but the logic was still right. Let's listen to the customer first.
Yeah.
And we're going to do it. Now let's work out how.
Yeah.
And that mentality persisted. So, for instance, the value-added products I'm talking about, today we have a portfolio of over 1,100 products. Fajitas, wraps, sausages, burgers, meatballs, in pastry, we've got rubs, marinades, dry, wet. You know, there's just an endless list. And by the way, packaging also plays a part in that too. So foil trays as opposed to plastic, all sorts of things. Single servings versus family dinners, roasts where you just all the vegetables around and just shove them. So they were all relatively straightforward. And in fact, today it's more product renovation than innovation, but it still serves the function of giving the shopper something new in chicken every time they go there.
Did you have one focus at that time? Was this talking to customers and finding out what their needs were? Was that your singular focus, or was it kind of part of an overall strategy?
There wasn't a strategy, being very honest with you. There wasn't at this stage. What there was us getting traction with customers because we were doing this, and we just said, let's keep going. Okay? We never sat back and really said, right, look, let's strategically focus ourselves. We didn't do that, being honest. I suppose in hindsight, the one thing we did do right was get close to customer. Never a bad thing to do, never. Secondly, was getting ourselves involved in their business. Very smart thing to do. And then the third thing, that as part of the service, we became experts in information. So we bought all Kantar and data about the business at the retail level. So when we went into them, so if we were one customer, we could immediately say, well, that promotion worked elsewhere and we know what it can do. And that helped us put down the right amount of stock So that all helped as well.
Mm-hmm.
But look, in the end of the day, it was about trying to maximize. We buy flocks from farmers, but we sell sizes to chicken,
mm-hmm.
to customers, I should mm-hmm. say, individuals. In between those two things, you give weight away. You don't get paid for that weight,
mm-hmm.
and the trick was how to minimize that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one of the best ways of minimizing that is getting with your customer and now propose promotions on sizes, for instance, that you have available.
Yeah.
You can imagine. Mm-hmm. So it was practical stuff, far mm-hmm. more than strategic.
On your own side, was there any weaknesses that you felt were highlighted during this period or throughout the whole time you were managing the company, and how did you mitigate those weaknesses as they came up?
Well, I'd never been in a sales environment before. Never.
Mm.
Absolutely never. And now here I was in front of seasoned purchasing directors. These guys were, I mean, at the top of the game. These are people who've learned how to buy strategically.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that I got advice, and I still say it to anybody today, the best selling technique is honesty. Do not say you can deliver when you have a doubt. Go back, find out, confirm. And if there's one thing we got right, particularly over competitors, was exactly that. Was be honest with your customer.
Mm-hmm.
And listen, for God's sake, listen to what he's telling you. So that was a learning that I got. I did find myself hugely, I was out of my depth.
Mm-hmm.
I had such little confidence going in on this.
Yeah.
But you know what? It had to be done.
Mm-hmm.
My father certainly couldn't help me. But I could see once we found out, you know, the first case of Supergun problem that I mentioned earlier, once we saw that, we hold on for a second, there's something here. Through going and solving problems, I remember listening to Michael Smurfit back in 2007, and he made the point that he went from Clongo straight into the business. He didn't go to college. And he said, I think that was a positive for me because I didn't understand the risks I was taking.
Mm.
All I did was solve the problem in front of me.
Mm-hmm.
And in a sense, that's a great mindset to have. And I was a bit like that, just what the hell is the problem in front of you? Go solve the problem.
Mm-hmm.
Try and analyze it and all that. Now, being honest, sometimes you just have to make a gut. You know, the information was imperfect. You were just, as a bit like Bill Gates said of Microsoft when they were dealing with IBM, you ride the bear. Hang on. Just stay with the bear, you know? That was one philosophy that I fell to. The other one I found I struggled with as well was that at the start of it, I knew pretty much everybody in the business. You could walk, you could chat to the ones on the production line, to the farmers, to everything. But we started getting very big. So we had a nighttime production. I wasn't even there, so I didn't know these people.
Mm.
So how do you enthuse them? How do you build them? And if I'm honest, I don't think I did a good job in that until we came to a strategic approach, which happened a lot longer than that.
It was
2010.
Let's talk about 2003 first.
The year was 2003. As I said, I had been the finance director, and I could see clearly that because we'd hit the limit, the capacity limit within our processing plant, we could not grow. And growth was something we always did. And what it meant was the extra bit of margin that we earned from the growth could be put to the extra bit of cost that came, because pricing in a market that's oversupplied, which is what we were, the competitors would always price on the lower end, hoping that tomorrow will get better.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And we had to compete in that world. And it was extremely difficult.
Mm-hmm.
It really, really was.
Even with being kind of integrated into your customers at this point?
Even integrated with your customers, you know, it was still hard. But this limit of your capacity meant that your customers weren't happy anymore. Your quality wasn't great. You were pushing the production line too hard. You were damaged. There was just so many issues. People were unhappy because either the product wasn't coming right, or there was disgruntled employees because they knew they were producing junk as well. And we had bank issues. We had credit issues. We had, I remember, union issues at the time as well. It was just horrendous. And in a world like that, when you're leading the organization, just you're punch drunk. Issues are coming at you literally on an hourly basis. and you're trying to solve one, and then another one hits you, and you go off on that, and you're like rabbit holes. You're chasing or after the next problem type of thing, and it just means you're getting nothing done. I had a friend in college, Philip Berber, and Philip, after UCD, left and went to the UK, and I know went bankrupt twice there. And then he went to America, and I heard he went bankrupt again. And by September 2000, we had a reunion of the VCOM class, and there he said to me, you know, Vincent, I think I've solved the problem. You know, I think I'm on a good one here. And I just said, look, Philip, you know, how are you and the kids? I really don't need to, we don't need to show off about what we're doing. Mm. Anyway, little did I know, but 4 months later, in January 2001, he sold his business for $430 million. He'd come up with the first online brokerage in the US. And what was also fascinating is that 2 months later, March 2001, the dot-com bubble burst. So his timing was superb. Anyway, so out of that, he became a very, very wealthy man, very generously looked after all his family here in Ireland and his kids in the States and everything. And then he had 200 and something million left over. And it really got in on him. He wanted to, himself and his wife, Donna, really worried about what their life was going to be like and what they were going to do with this money. It just, you know, it was a big issue for them. They wanted to do good. Anyway, his wife, Donna, about 3 months later, had a dream about Ethiopia. They'd never been, knew very little about it. They followed their dream, and they went to Ethiopia and effectively created the IDA of Ethiopia with their own money, and did an amazing job over there. Anyway, so here I am in 2003. I'm worried sick. I just rang him up and I said, look, Philip, I know you're a huge success, but I know you also went bust three times. Like, how did you get up? And I'll tell you why. I think I'm gone myself. I can see it in a relatively short period of time in the future. I will be gone bust. He said, how far? And I said, I think about 2004 I'll be gone. He said, okay. He said, what's your problems? And I said, well, I think I'm going to have to take the kids out of school. I think I'm going to have to sell my home. And I really hope my marriage puts up for it. And then I've got business issues. I've got customers and banks and quality and unions and boom, 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 boom. I listed out, I think, 12 problems to him. And so he said to me, he said, Vincent, I'm going to help you, but I'm not going to give you any money. So what I want you to do is I want you to go in and tell your wife everything that you've just told me, because I'm telling you, yes, you may lose your house, and yes, your children may have to go to another school, but they're going to love you more if you keep them honest, keep your wife honest, that she knows exactly what's going on. He says, now let's talk about the business issues. I will help you, but I will not give you any money. I said, okay. So he said, right, you've got 12 business issues there. By next week, you must have solved number 4. So fair enough. And he says, ring me back. This was on a Saturday. He said, ring me back the next Saturday. It was on a Saturday in November, I remember well. He says, ring me back again and we'll talk about how you get on. So next Saturday, I rang him up. He in hot Dallas and me in wintry. He said, right, you did number 4. Well done. Okay, well, now, for next week, you definitely need to have solved number 7, whatever number 7 was. Mm-hmm. Let's say it was a customer account, you had to collect the money or something. But I need you to be thinking about number 2. Number 2 is coming to the horizon. Think about it, and we'll talk about it next week. Go off and out. And so I came back the following week, and I said, yeah, solve number 7, this is what I did, and this is what I think about number 2. And he said, well, I think you might be better to look at it this way. We discussed it out a bit. He says, okay, let's do number 2. You definitely need to know number 2. And look, problem number 8 is coming down the track fast. So did again the same. He said, right, next week we need to hit 2 together. We need to hit 8 and number 1. Those two need to be done. And look, just do them. Talk to them. And so what he was actually doing for me was prioritizing. So when you're the leader of a business and things are going wrong, all sorts of problems are coming at you every which way. And there's so many that, quite frankly, you're punched drunk. You can't actually act. And you're doing nothing almost. So what he was giving me permission to do was to solve problems one by one. independent of all the issues, no problems looking at it objectively, he could prioritize for you. And he had the experience in business to know the weight of the various problems he was asking to solve in the right order. And so after 6 weeks, I said, thanks, Philip. And so out of that came a can-do spirit. And in the following year, we sold 40% of the business to raise capital. We closed down the factories. We sold off property. And we borrowed an awful lot of money. And we spent 23 million on a plant when we were making a couple hundred thousand a year. Couldn't happen normally, but we did it. And I'm so thankful, because one of the things that absolutely surprised us was the reaction of customers. Because customers were looking at all these 13 chicken companies on there, 14 chicken companies on the island, and they could see it what didn't make sense. So when they saw somebody investing in new technology, they said, okay, we know you're going to be one of them here. So we actually picked up business because of the fact that we had the gumption to go out and invest. Mm-hmm. And we picked up business, and that in turn expedited the decline of others. So you had a positive twist coming at that. And so in the years between, in 2001, the first chicken company went bust. And between that and 2012, we had 8 companies going out of business. We had 2 forced sales, and we had some amalgamations. But in essence, what happened was, we were from 14 down to 4, sorry, that's including Northern Ireland, 3 in the sales only.
That's all for the first half of my interview with Vincent Carton of Manor Farm. Next week, you'll hear how Vincent and the team got the business back on track and the strategy they used to grow profits from 500,000 to 13 million in just 7 years. Make sure you hit subscribe so you don't miss out. This podcast is produced by JetBooks, an online bookkeeping service dedicated to giving you real-time financial information at the click of a button. Our team of qualified accountants leverage the power of cloud technology to automate your manual processes and cut the cost of your finance function in half. Head to jetbooks.ie/resources to pick up our free step-by-step guide on how to automate your bookkeeping. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe and leave a 5-star review. It really helps others to find the show. I'm your host, Connor Carney. Thanks for listening.